Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
You have these imbalances that are built in into society, and the trend there is clearly not good. And, you know, during the Great Depression, an argument against FDR and the New Deal was that we need to have some sort of great cleansing moment where this dirty, corrupt system just breaks itself and we build something better. And you heard that argument both on the far right and also on the far left at that moment. And what FDR and the New Deal did, and I think with philosophical backing from Keynes at his sort of most ambitious and intellectually exciting, was reimagine government, not just capitalism, but reimagine government in such a way that those that type of cleansing, that painful, you know, rip off the Band-Aid thing or you know, shoot people in the liver kind of strategy was not necessary.
In today's episode, we brought Zachary Carter, author of The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes, back on the podcast. The book is now out on paperback. It came out on 420. Of course, we had to offer you the episode with Kevin Sabe to make the holiday, quote unquote, really specific. So we decided to push the episode with Zachary till today. But there's a lot of great stuff here. Zach is deeply interested in economic policy. He's talking about capitalism, which he's also focusing on at the Omidyar Network. So we're talking everything from the PPP program to what capitalism looks like after the crisis and all that good stuff. Quick note, we received plenty of incoming on the Kevin Sabat episode than we've ever gotten before. So do not worry, we will be getting back to all of you soon.
Yeah, I really enjoy talking with Zach. His biography of Keynes is just so incredible. Keynes himself is just a really fascinating figure, and I reference it a little bit in the podcast. I've been reading a little bit about the lead up to the Great Depression and the ideological clinging to gold, and he was one of those people who, it's not that he had the right ideas, it's that he had the right mental frameworks to ask why questions, to say, wait, why do we do things this way? Can we do things differently? What if we tried a new economic model, which is tied more towards prosperity for all? Obviously, that's something that I subscribe to. Whether you want to call that Keynesian or not, I think people get very deep into the woods with annoying arguments. But overall, both Zach and Keynes are people who are thinking about where things are headed in this tumultuous and crazy time, especially in the midst of the post-pandemic. So really, really enjoy talking with Zach. As always, you can find Zach's book at bookshop.org, which is linked in our show notes. That's a way that you can help an independent bookstore during COVID-19, and you can help our show. We've been selling tens of thousands of dollars worth of books. Reminder, you don't just have to buy Zach's book. You can buy literally any book you want as long as you follow our link, and we will still get the credit for it, so we really appreciate it. And with that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Today's question comes from Apple Podcasts. Quick reminder, if you want to submit a question, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com or reply to the Substack. Today's question comes from Mark. Love the show. We'll be cooking up a few questions for a Q&A portion at some point. But first, I've got a few questions. One, you have a bookstore, but is there a similar small business option for audiobooks? Two, on the audiobook topic, do you know if Frank DiStefano's book will have an audio version? I can't DM him on Twitter, and I generally don't publicly post. Hopefully, given the answer to the first question, I can listen via a service you guys endorse. And finally, I listen to you on Spotify, and I've never used Apple Podcasts. What's the best way and place to leave a review? I'll just answer the third one real quick. If you are on Spotify, of which we are noticing a lot of you are now coming in through Spotify, our numbers have really gotten a lot bigger there over the past month or two. No worries. We're going to trust that you are doing that in good faith. You can send in a question. We will forgive you for it. But Sagar, let's go down the first question about small business options.
As far as I can tell, there is no similar version of Bookshop for audiobooks. And look, this is part of what we talk about on the show. The truth is that Audible, which is owned by Amazon, has just made it incredibly convenient in order to purchase audiobooks, not just because of the use of their app, but because of their credit system, which flattens the price of an audiobook. I don't know if you guys have ever tried to buy audiobooks ad hoc. I actually have, and Marshall, I'm sure you have as well. It almost never makes financial sense in order to buy a audiobook one-off, unless there's some sort of sale or something going on, rather than participate in the Audible credit system. And so from what we can tell, Audible is the most cost-effective way and frankly the best way to participate in this. And so we're thinking about maybe doing some sort of affiliate thing with them.
And a quick thing to add to this, I was just searching on Google, speaking of big tech, as you're talking, and apparently there's something called Libro.fm, Libro, like in Spanish, .fm, where you can actually purchase audiobooks from your local retailer. So if anyone is deeply interested in this, check it out. Let us know. We're open to suggestions. We're not deeply researching the Q&A at this point. So definitely check it out. Let us know if there's anything. And then secondly, I do not think there's an audio version of Frank's book. If you haven't checked out his YouTube channel, definitely go there. His content's really good. I definitely think that he should make an Audible version, or should at least turn his YouTube videos into a podcast. We'll definitely pass along the note to Frank. We're looking forward to doing a lot more with him moving forward.
As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it. Let's jump into it.
Zachary Carter, welcome back to The Realignment.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Good to see you, Zach.
Good to see you, Zach.
We had you on back in August to talk about your book, The Price of Peace. Two things have happened that we want to delve into. Firstly, The Price of Peace is now out on paperback. It's been a while, almost a year since your book came out. So a lot of folks who are obsessed with Keynes and economic history have almost certainly gotten to it, but there's a new part of the audience who might not have as deep of an economic understanding or a focus on the topic. So how about you just contextualize your work and articulate why this book, which was amazingly reviewed, got a lot of like great press, why this is of relevance to anyone who likes economics or capitalism?
I think Keynes, at least when I came to Keynes, I thought of him as sort of this policy technician, somebody who came up with neat little devices to solve problems, the most famous of which was deficit spending in a recession. Cool, you've got this new gadget that alleviates suffering and brings recessions to an end. When I came to study him after the financial crisis in 2008, I started to see him more as a philosopher, somebody who thought about what capitalism is, what an economy is, what we mean when we talk about economic problems, and what we're trying to solve when we use economic policy as a tool in a democracy. And one of the more important lessons from Keynes's life is that he's a philosopher who matters during crisis. When there is something happening that seems unexpected and the world is moving in a direction that people don't really understand, Keynes is somebody you can turn to and say, okay, here's a way to think about the world going off the rails and what to do when that happens. It's not necessarily a set of, he doesn't necessarily provide us with a set of foolproof tools and policy options, but he provides us, I think, with a way of thinking about how people react to the unexpected. And it's just very difficult for me, having grown up, I was born in the 80s, early 80s, I grew up in the 90s, it's very difficult for me to look at the world of the 21st century and say, everything around me is something that I anticipated. I completely saw the world moving in this direction. The COVID pandemic is something that is, I think, you know, obviously nobody saw this thing coming. That was a moment of radical uncertainty, which was probably good for my book sales. But you know, everything from the invasion of Iraq to the election of Barack Obama to the election of Donald Trump, the widespread acceptance of same-sex marriage, there have been some pretty big cultural shifts that feel normal in retrospect that I just absolutely did not see coming. And some of them I'm enthusiastic about, like the cultural acceptance of same-sex marriage. Some of them I'm not enthusiastic about, like, you know, the election of Donald Trump. But there have been moments where it became very clear that the world does not operate according to the assumptions of elite people in power. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily use elite there in a pejorative sense, but there is a consensus about how the world works that was forged in the 1990s that I think we're still living with some of the sort of aftermath of that consensus. It's shifting now, but that consensus was really hegemonic for quite some period of time, and it just turned out that the world didn't work that way. And I think Keynes is somebody you can point to when it turns out that you're wrong about the world. What can you do when things are when the world around you is uncertain and the future feels uncertain?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things I appreciate about your book, I'm reading another book right now called Lords of Finance, which was very hot like 10 years ago, but it's very much similar, which is that there was like this ideological clinging to gold, to like the gold standard during and leading up to the Great Depression. And Keynes makes like these little vignettes throughout the book where being like, you guys are out of your mind. Like, we don't have to do this. There are different things that we can do. Like, we don't have to run the mercantile economy like we did in 1850, right? And so that's where it's what you're saying really is resonating with me, because you're right, which is that it's most valuable not to think of him as like, you know, strictly within economics, but more as somebody who, I mean, he was famously completely wrong about World War I, right? Like, he was like, well, there's no way that there won't be enough money in order to fund this war. Like, and he would get really angry at people who thought that World War I would last for more than a year. But then a year later, he's working like in the British Treasury or in the bank or whatever. And he's like coming with all these, you know, financing schemes, and like his mind is updating. And so if you are to think of him in that paradigm of where we are like today, where do you think, like, if there's a Keynes of today, what were some of the shattering moments over the last year that broke our current or past themes of understanding economics?
It's really funny. Donald Trump, president who I just have very few positive things to say about Donald Trump as a president. But one of the things that's really remarkable about his presidency is the way things that were considered totally beyond the pale in economic policy, these are things that don't have the same kind of moral salience that, say, you know, border separations do, family separations of the border, but tariffs or publicly leaning on the Federal Reserve to keep interest rates low, operating at a massive federal deficit, courting larger deficits when much of the economic establishment is saying the country is at full employment. These were things that seemed impossible in the Barack Obama administration, which, you know, at least within my lifetime, you know, I think for all its flaws, the Barack Obama administration was the most progressive administration that I had seen as, you know, during my life. And it showed with Donald Trump that there weren't these overpowering institutional vested interests, various, you know, structural barriers to these policy differences. You just needed somebody in charge to actually do this stuff. And all of a sudden, this huge field of economic policy was available. And, you know, not all of these tools are good tools. I don't think Donald Trump wielded all of them particularly well, but I mean, I think it's very hard to argue with the monetary policy that Donald Trump pursued. You know, the Fed under Jerome Powell has been better for working people than any Fed in my lifetime, and that is unexpected. Jerome Powell is a totally boring, like, corporate private equity straight-laced Wall Street guy, and yet he's running the Fed basically the way, you know, ex-hippie economists in the 80s were saying the Fed should be running the economy. And I think that there were a series of moments over the course of the Trump presidency that I think were maybe more salient to what's happening right now than the pandemic specifically. But I certainly think the multiple updates to the CARES Act, I think one of the things that I got wrong about the CARES Act when that passed was that there would be one shot, that policymakers would get one bill, and after that, people would say, no, 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 and they would pivot to austerity immediately. Maybe it was because Donald Trump was president and just insisted on this stuff and didn't care about Republican orthodoxy in the economic establishment in this way. Maybe it's because the intellectual consensus had just shifted, because it proved for the last 3 years that giant deficits weren't leading to absolute disaster. They did re-up. And then by the end of, you know, in September and October, you had Trump calling for these $2,000 checks. I thought that was just a total watershed moment where people in looking at fiscal policy, just said, okay, look, the barriers that we have erected to this are our own barriers. They're not out there in the world. They're in our minds, and we're projecting them onto the world. And there's a certain kind of there's a certain, you know, freedom freaks people out sometimes. And I think there's a certain fear within the economics profession that if you give policymakers this much leeway to make decisions, they'll do something insanely reckless with it, and they'll destroy the economy, and they'll destroy the world. And maybe they will. I mean, who knows? I don't have a lot of faith in politicians, but the world seems like it's been on a pretty bad path for the past 25 years, and maybe having some more tools available will lead to a better place. I certainly can't imagine the Biden administration coming out of the gate with, you know, basically, you know, a little over $4 trillion in deficit spending out of the gate without the precedents that were set by the Trump administration. I didn't see that coming. That was all of that was surprising to me.
Yeah.
I want to pull a couple points out because you've said a couple things that people who don't deeply follow Democratic politics in 2008, 2009, or the financial industry are going to miss, because what I thought was so funny, when you see the CARES Act, so support for businesses, everything like that, you saw the 2008, 2009 playbook start up again, in the sense you had a bunch of folks, center left, center right, say things like, oh, the bailouts for corporations are coming, government spending is bad. That was the whole thing. We had Scott Galloway on the podcast, and I think he's a good exemplar of like center left thinking within a part of the Democratic Party. He went on this rant. I love Scott. He went on this rant against supporting Strand Bookstore. And he's like, it's a company. Why would we bail out a company? This is like when we bail out the big banks and it's all bad. And it's insane that we're doing this. And in 2008, 2009, that idea that these bailouts, that this alleviating suffering that you referenced earlier, basically just meant corporations and not actual people, really drove the politics of the Obama administration in terms of think what they thought they could do. It drove the backlash in the Tea Party. So not just Obamacare, but also that idea. And it really limited the economic possibilities. And what I just loved happened here politically, obviously I'm not an economist, so I don't understand the long-term effects here, is that policymakers said, okay, yeah, let's bail out some corporations, some businesses, and then we'll give money to people. It's as if we in 2009 had said, hey, look, there's this insane once in a generation financial crisis. Let's bail out the industry so we don't have a global depression, but let's also bail out mortgage owners. Let's also make sure that people get supported too. So can you just comment on how the playbook that we're articulating here has really affected A, like the Democratic Party, but B, critics of this policy? Because the one thing I want to add to this too is just the fact that it's been fascinating to see deficit hawks really struggle with this idea, because now that policymakers just rammed through the opposition, we're left with just a lot of semi-bad faith, but what about the grandchildren? What about phantom inflation? So I just love for you to comment on all this, because I think it's just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I think there's two things that really jump out at me from your point there. I mean, one is that economists, you say you're not an economist, and so you don't know what the long-term tail effects of this thing are going to be. Economists don't know either. They think they know. They have a set of models they've set up, and those models have been, you know, the sort of establishment 1990s center-left, center-right, quasi-Keynesian consensus had predicted certain things, that none of which came true over the past 25 years. And so
what did they predict would happen?
I mean, the biggest thing, so look, I mean, I don't have a particular bone to pick with Paul Krugman, but I think the evolution of his ideas, there's a nice piece in the London Review of Books by Adam Tooze on a recent collection of Krugman essays that details the way that his thought has changed. But, you know, in around the Bush tax cuts era, you know, Paul Krugman and I both feel a sense of deep moral outrage over the Bush tax cuts, that they're unfair to the country, to give big cuts for rich people is morally grotesque. But Krugman was worried that we were going to go bankrupt, that we're going to run out of money. Not only was it morally unfair, it was also sort of technologically impossible. If we did this, the country was going to go bankrupt.
This is like Clinton thought, you know, this is like Clinton thought.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. And right. And sort of harnessing all of these sort of progressive Democratic Party ideals and sort of scientizing them with economic thought and economic analysis. And then when we didn't go bankrupt, not only did the Bush tax cuts not bankrupt the country, but the Iraq war didn't bankrupt the country. What really was a big problem for in terms of how people lived every day was the financial crisis, which had nothing to do with the fiscal policy that the Bush administration was pursuing. To me, I think that revealed that economists were looking at the wrong things, and this sort of impetus.
Wait, Zach, Marshall, one quick thing that I want to pull out for people, because we have a decent number of Gen Z listeners who literally were not cognizant during this point, which is that if you're looking at that late early 2000s debate, the critique of the Bush tax cuts were, wait, Bill Clinton, we're paying off the debt. We're paying
surplus.
Off, there's a surplus. And Bush's argument was, let's use the surplus to send it back to the people. And obviously there's a inequality argument, but that was the argument. So the point here is that even if you'd continued to pay down the federal debt, that would not have negated the 2008 financial crisis in any way whatsoever. Like, that's the key point here.
Oh, and I mean, Stephanie Kelton is very fond of an argument that if we had continued to pay down the debt, it would have created a greater amount of private sector debt, which probably would have actually exacerbated the financial crisis. I'm not sure the connections are as strong as Stephanie suggests, but to be perfectly honest, I'm just much more skeptical about certainty in these things than most economists are. So I find Stephanie's case generally persuasive, but I never have the confidence that she has when she presents her arguments. She does happen to be right on all of her predictions of the past 20 or so years. She's one of the few economists who really did actually say, no, this is, you guys are wrong. If the tax cuts will just result in more inequality, they won't destroy the country. Although we can argue whether more inequality destroyed the country in this important way, but your point, Marshall, about the sort of moral narrative that finds its way into economic policy, I think, is really critical. And after the financial crisis, look, it was really hard to look at people at these banks who had done incredibly reckless things and been paid outrageous sums of money at the time. And say that we need to save those folks and their bonuses, and I think there's a really good faith argument that we shouldn't have. I mean that mm-hmm. maybe you need to keep the credit machine going, but you certainly don't need to pay off the bonuses. And there was a particular ugliness with the financial crisis in that it was centered on housing, and so the people who lost in this weren't just other investors. You didn't just have a sort of abstract breakdown of the credit system, the way you kind of did in, say, 1929, where the stock market crashes and the people who lose money are people who put a shitload of money in the stock market. I mean, you can feel bad for people when they lose a lot of money, but people who have lots of spare cash to throw into the stock market, how sorry do you really feel for them? People who are just trying to buy a house, trying to live a normal life, trying to live something that we have been told our whole lives is an ordinary American thing to do. It's very hard to look at people who have their houses ripped away from them and look at bankers coming away with lots of money and say, this is a totally fair system, because it's unfair, right? And the pain of the recession was totally disproportionate. But I think that impetus to apply some sort of to apply some sort of moral decency to the way that you structure the bailouts often carried over into a kind of liquidationism on the left, which, when the CARES Act came out, said, look, if we do anything to support the private sector, what we're doing is rewarding bad actors who made bad decisions. And that becomes very quickly something like what the Austrian economists of the 1920s were arguing for, and which John Maynard Keynes argued forcefully against. At some point, these corporations are the source of income for people. This is where people work. I take a lot of the new anti-monopoly, antitrust arguments very seriously. But in a crisis, that tells you, if you have a higher concentration of corporate power in most of your industries, that means if you want to save the jobs, you have to save those corporations. And the project of reform has to be separated from the rescue project. If you try to to do reform. If you hold back on your rescue maneuvers out of this need for some sort of moral reform movement, you end up just doing a lot of social damage that is very, very difficult to undo.
I'm so glad I had this fight endlessly at the time. People were like, Ruth's Chris is a multi-million dollar company and they got a PPP loan. I'm like, yeah, you know who also works at Ruth's Chris? Like waiters who don't have any money right now and maybe they need some. Like, come on. You drove me completely insane. And everything that you're talking about, I want to get to this like meta shift in economic thinking, which I think has happened within the last year. There's a joke amongst wonks that econ Twitter runs the White House. And I don't think that makes sense to like outside of like 200 people, but I'll do my best at explaining it, which is that like you were talking about, these hippy-dippy economists of the 1980s, the retconning of the Obama administration, the general consensus that Obama didn't go big enough in the 2008 financial crisis, that people like Larry Summers and Paul Krugman, and that a deficit-minded austerity politics ruined the Obama administration politically and ruined the U.S. economy, took hold amongst a group of wonks. And that now has taken hold in the White House under Joe Biden. And I'm curious for your perspective. You and I talked a lot before the election, and I know one of the things we were most worried about was that Paul Krugman and Larry Summers, who was advising the Biden administration, was going to come in and do all the same wrong things that Obama did back in 2008. And the truth is, we should be honest, the opposite happened. I mean, frankly, like they've been pretty good on economics. They've gone big. Everything they're doing has super majorities of support amongst the American people. I've actually been shocked. Like Biden, I would say outside of like maybe two incidents, has not really waded into the culture war at all and has been focused much more on economic policy. What do you make of that? Given that, you know, Joe Biden, 2005 bankruptcy, senator from MBNA, all of that, 50 years gave us reason to be very suspect of this man. And then he comes in and basically just does the complete opposite. What happened in your opinion?
It's totally wild, and I struggle with this. So I'll give you one answer here, but with a caveat that on different days of the week, I have different answers to this question. I think it's an important question.
Wednesday.
today, I think the pandemic is a really important factor in what happened here, because if you look at the narrative of the Joe Biden campaign, it's Donald Trump is an aberration from American history. And we have this arc of goodness and decency that goes throughout our history. And all of a sudden, this terrible man shows up and he says awful things in Charlottesville and the Unite the Right rally that happened there. And you know, everything terrible that we've seen on the far right that he's fomenting and stuff. And so if we just get away from Donald Trump, we can go back to normal and things will be good again. And that is not the way he is governed. He has governed I think temperamentally he's governed that way. Yeah, I think it's
in rhetoric, you're right. Yeah.
He'll say things like, come on, man, you know, why are we doing this policy? Yeah, come on, man. Yeah, of course we're just gonna spend $4 trillion. Come on. So that you know, and I think there's a significant portion of the population that likes that style of leadership particularly after the Trump administration. But you know, the pandemic said, look, whatever happened because of the pandemic, whatever you do, if you're Joe Biden, there is no normal. You're not going to go back to 1998 or 2013. It's just not going to happen. There is this mm-hmm. huge crisis that's ongoing that you have to address. You are taking office in the middle of a global disaster. And I think, you know, I don't think it's an accident that Joe Biden hoisted this big portrait of FDR in the Oval Office. I think he's got people in his administration who see clear parallels to FDR taking office at the deepest moment of the Great Depression in 1933. And the way that FDR responded to that was not necessarily with a set of, you know, clearly defined, you know, expert consensus economic policies, right? Like Keynes writes the general theory in 1936. Roosevelt takes office in 1933. The stuff that Roosevelt is doing is a little bit experimental. He does know what he wants to do, but there is no real like solid intellectual foundation for the things that he is doing. He just feels like he has to, because otherwise the country is going to fall apart. And I think there's some of that happening right now with Biden. So the pandemic creates a new logic. And then I also think the Capitol Hill riot and on January 6th changes the equation quite a bit, because since the financial crisis, you've had people like me and I think people like you, Sagar, saying, I'm sorry, Marshall, if you said this, I just haven't seen it.
I don't tweet, so these are the consequences thereof. You know,
there is this view expressed largely, I think on kind of econ adjacent Twitter and the econ adjacent intelligentsia, that if you have these levels of inequality that keep increasing, you are courting authoritarian politics. You are courting some sort of far right reaction against democracy, because what you keep proving as inequality increases is that democracy, which is supposed to be about everybody, isn't actually about everybody. And if it's not about everybody, then why not just get somebody who's about me in charge? That logic seems pretty intuitive to me. There's a lot of that in my book. I think it was pretty intuitive to Keynes too. But that was easy to dismiss when the country seemed relatively pacific. I mean, we have a lot of violence in this country, but it's easy to isolate it as, oh, well, it's a mass shooting, or it's, you know, the criminal justice system and police violence. This isn't a response to inequality. This is just a particularly unique American pathology that's being expressed. It's really hard to dismiss the Capitol Hill riot as something that's just this sort of unique, oops, you know, 400 years of American difficulty being expressed. There's clearly an attack on democracy that's coming and that's underway. How severe and how successful it will be is not obvious, but I think if you're taking office as a president after that, the stakes are higher. You know, if you screw up economic policy and you overshoot a little bit and spend too much and you have like 5 or 6% inflation, that is not that big a deal compared to having the Capitol overrun by a bunch of armed fascists, having elections overturned. The problems are just totally different. And so I think the views about, first of all, a lot of these technocratic experts were just wrong for 25 years. So it's harder to take them seriously when they say, oh, something bad will happen. But the types of things that they say will go wrong, oh no, productivity will be below trend. So what? I mean, we're talking about the survival of democracy here.
So here's a question that will tie in the second change in your life that I've referenced at the start, which is you are working with the Omid Yar Network as a writer in residence on a reimagining capitalism initiative. And I want to go back to something you said a bit ago, which is the point that there are a lot of people who are put off by the idea of, during a crisis, bailing out the banks, saving these monopolized industries, really is just going to double down on the system and prevent it from getting changed. So I think the question would be, like, let's be devil's advocates for that ideology. When are you going to make a change then? Because I think what you would easily say is, look, after the 2008 financial crisis, there are all these books about everything is changing and this and this and this and that. And then very quickly, things didn't change. And I think it's very easy to see, and we're seeing this already. Sagar and I are pumped to look into this over the next few months, but you're seeing a lot of the big takes that people had about COVID changing everything are looking a little weaker than they were before. There was a real moment of possibility you saw in May and June of 2020, which just doesn't exist right now. So how do you respond to the critique that there was just this moment and the decision just to back up and save things to preserve a status quo that we understood and felt safe with is going to prevent the long-term changes that are needed to actually reimagine capitalism? A good way of summing this up is, actually, Zach, there isn't going to be a reimagining of capitalism, because the time to do that was in May and June, and now that's over, and now Amazon is even more powerful than it was before, so good luck with that. How do you respond to this argument?
I mean, it's a powerful argument, because Amazon obviously is even more powerful than it was before the pandemic. I mean, there's a great piece in the New York Times over the weekend about an industry very near and dear to my heart, the book industry, which shows that essentially people discover new authors by going into bookstores and browsing. You go and hang out in the bookstore, you pick things up, you look at it. That is how people find new authors. when you order something online, you are searching for it. You know what you want, you're going to get it. And the stuff that people search for is stuff they already know. And so book sales over the past year, on net, they're up quite a bit. But it's book sales for people who are already super famous.
Only, can I give an example? Because I read this article, people find it funny. Snoop Dogg's cookbook was not a crazy bestseller when it came out a few years ago, but it sold hundreds of thousands of copies on Amazon over the past year. There's this funny anecdote where they talk about the Chronicle Books, I think was the publisher. They think, oh man, we're screwed. And then their old catalog of just big names. You're stuck at home during COVID. You search cookbook. Yeah, Snoop Dogg, he's chill. I'll go with that.
Yeah, he sold 205,000 cookbooks in 2020. Okay. That's a lot of cookbooks. And another stat in the article is that 98% of books that were released in 2020 sold less than 5,000 copies. Now, the trick there is that most books don't sell very well when they come out. So if you sell 10 or 12,000 copies of your book, you are always in the top, 5 or 10% of sales. But there's a clear compression that has gone on there. And so I think the reform moment, one of the things that's interesting though about Biden, I mean, the reform moment does have to be now. And I think on antitrust and anti-monopoly stuff, you look at the personnel he's looking to name. I mean, these people are the real deal. I mean, Lina Khan, who he's discussed as an FTC appointee, Rohit Chopra going to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The CFPB, I think we think of this as a place that just tells banks, don't steal from me. But, and that's true, but you could also punish banks with structural reforms that are basically anti-monopoly reforms. Rohit's somebody who understands that stuff very well. Tim Wu getting a position on the National Economic Council. I mean, these are really serious people who know their stuff and understand the relationship between the market and society and the monopolizing corporation and society very well. So I do think there will be people in positions of institutional power who can use the regulatory state to go after some of the more blatant excesses of monopoly capitalism. But, I also think big tech is an easy target because it's just so obviously out of control and over the top. There are only so many Mark Zuckerbergs and Jeff Bezoses in the world. The broader problem of excessive concentration and inequality, which are clearly related, is not just about four companies, right? It's about a trend that's happening throughout the economy and throughout society. If you don't live in one of six or seven cities in the United States, your job opportunities are declining even during good times. If you live in one of those six or seven places, that's great, but your rent is rising even during good times. You have these imbalances that are built into society, and the trend there is clearly not good. And I think during the Great Depression, an argument against FDR and the New Deal was that we need to have some sort of great cleansing moment where this dirty, corrupt system just breaks itself and we build something better. And you heard that argument both on the far right and also on the far left at that moment. And what FDR and the New Deal did, and I think with philosophical backing from Keynes at his sort of most ambitious and intellectually exciting, was reimagine government, not just capitalism, but reimagine government in such a way that that type of cleansing, that painful, rip off the Band-Aid thing or shoot people in the liver kind of strategy, was not necessary. That you could get progressive reforms. You could, in fact, have a society that took seriously the idea of taking care of itself. But that wasn't just a stimulus bill, right? That wasn't just spending, $2 trillion on infrastructure and $2 trillion on income support. That was a concentrated effort throughout the government to build new institutions that had a sense of responsibility to certain parts of society. That is a really hard thing to do. It's a really hard thing to do with divided government. It was not easy for Roosevelt to do, when he had this huge Democratic control of Congress, because the Democratic Party wasn't the Democratic Party it is today. You had these liberals in the North and conservatives in the South. Today we have you have to do whatever you're going to do, at least over the next 2 years, without legislation on most of this stuff. And that is really tricky stuff. So could you have done that in May? I'm actually a little bit skeptical about what the opportunities were other than providing more income support to people. I making the bailouts fairer, I think was on the table. I think if they hadn't allowed the super unemployment stuff to expire in July, I think the evaluations, a lot of the evaluations of the March and April legislation would have been more positive. I think PPP, you know, the small business relief stuff, I mean, that was pretty much like what people were saying.
It's a great program.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you should have done the bank bailouts, right? You get money, but you have to spend it on good things and you can't do stupid shit. You know, that was pretty good and largely successful. You know, the biggest problem with PPP is it's too small. So yes, there is clearly a reform moment that was not capitalized upon, but I'm a bit skeptical about what the actual possibilities were. And even today, you know, on the international front, a lot of the big crises facing the country are not just about income inequality, but about the way that we cooperate and structure our economy with other economies. The U.S. relationship with China, you know, I think there are elements of that deterioration which are unique to the style of diplomacy pursued by the last president. But a lot of that is because the economic relationship really is way, way out of balance, and that imbalance has been accelerating for some time. And there needs to be some sort of international mechanism established to help bring it back into balance. And that, to me, does not seem to be. I think, if anything, COVID has exposed the depth of that problem and made, I think, internationally, the momentum for actually doing something about it. I think there's more of that now than there was in May, and I think that's going to increase because the problem's just not going to go away.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. One of the things that I have to return to, though, because there are probably some Bitcoin crypto people who had an aneurysm whenever you said a couple of minutes ago, well, 5% inflation is just really not that bad, or, you know, decline in productivity. It's like, you didn't, and I see this take sometimes from people who are older. It'd be like, listen, you people didn't live through the 70s. Inflation was actually horrible. It was like, it wreaked havoc on the economy, you know, arguably, you know, got Carter out of office, like, all of this. What's your response to that? Number one, how should we think about inflation in the year 2021? Will the inflation predictions of the Bitcoin bros from the stimuli bill come true? And three, are we just thinking about it all completely wrong? Go ahead.
Sure. I mean, the easiest one is I think the Bitcoin bros are totally wrong. So no. But I like I said earlier, I mean, it feels like I'm picking on Stephanie Kelton here, but you know, I think Stephanie Kelton and Nathan Tankus have been very, very clear in their views about, you know, what causes inflation, how it happens, the mechanics of it. I think their story is more compelling than any other story I've heard, but I just don't have the same level of confidence that they have. I think, you know, the history of economics is the history of people confronting something they don't understand and something unexpected and having to adapt their mental model to reality. And it's possible that this mental model that's been really, really useful over the last 25 years will need to be adjusted by reality over the next couple of years. I do not think that they are going to need to adjust it to some sort of, you know, double-digit inflation or hyperinflationary environment. I think whatever the future is, my expectation is that it looks much more like what Nathan and Stephanie are talking about than what Olivier Blanchard and Larry Summers are talking about, or the Bitcoin bros at this sort of absurd edge. You know, inflation in the sort of Keynesian, the basic Keynesian model is that you get demand-driven inflation when there's more demand in the economy than there is supply of stuff. So I think John Stuart Mill said inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. That's, you know, Mill was talking about sort of a quantity theory of money approach. Mm-hmm. Keynes is talking about the purchasing power of the public. It's not necessarily tied to any, like, you know, monetary base. The Bitcoin bros will get mad about that. But, you know, I tend to side with the Keynesian perspective. If you do all this income support for people And you build all this infrastructure and people get paid to build the infrastructure and their incomes go way up. The thought is that they will have the purchasing power to bid up prices and the economy will overheat, meaning prices will rise. You know, that could happen. I think that the one reason why I'm just not super worried about it is that the 1970s were a confluence of a series of factors that developed over a decade. The 70s weren't a stimulus bill. There were multiple oil crises. There was the break with the Bretton Woods system. So we have a completely new international monetary and trade milieu that is just, the old one is just destroyed and replaced with nothing. And people are just feeling their way in the dark there. And then you probably do have some demand-driven inflation caused by the Vietnam War and the expanded social welfare projects of LBJ's Great Society. You have all of these things operating together at different times in different years. And inflation, it's not just this one straight line that goes up from 1971 to 1978. It goes way up, then it plateaus, it goes down, then it rises up again in response to different types of crises. And I think to the extent that we can anticipate the future here, if we overshoot with demand and spend too much money and let people live too high on the hog for a while, then we'll be in a situation where you need to tighten the economy. You need to reduce the amount of demand in the economy, and you do that through either higher interest rates or, you know, in other, you know, sort of more fiscal policy oriented approaches, higher taxes, maybe lower spending too. But that's not a policy world that is, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place. You've got a problem, you know what the tools are, you know they work, and you can use them to address the problem. In the 70s, you had both high unemployment and high inflation at different points in time. And if you tried to address one of those problems with you know, these fiscal and monetary levers, you would make the other problem worse. And so ultimately, the way that the United States chose to solve that problem with Paul Volcker was just to make unemployment really, really, really terrible. And you know, I don't think that was a particularly good solution. I don't think that the political era that was ushered in as a result was good. I do think there's a clear connection between austerity politics and the popularity of conservative ideas and conservative politics. So you know, you do have to tell yourself if you overshoot too far and you demand, you know, some sort of moderate recession to be imposed in order to cool things off, then yeah, you are playing a little bit with fire there. But 5-6% inflation, I mean, I you will see the prices going up. It will be clear in the data, and then you'll be able to respond to it. It's not like your hands will be tied the way they would be in the 1970s. So I think people who live through this are right that it feels, when it's the major political crisis of your day, it feels significant, particularly if you grow up with it, right? It feels really significant as you get older. There are thinkers like Friedrich Hayek, who grew up, you know, around the time of the Weimar Germany hyperinflation, spent the rest of his life just terrified of, you know, 1 or 2% increases in the consumer price index. And sometimes that was not warranted by the 1970s. You know, inflation is a thing, and he could say, "See, I was right all along." I think the type of crisis that really upsets whatever this kind of new economic paradigm is that's coming into focus here, we don't know what that crisis is. I don't think we can predict it. I don't think it's going to look like what happened in the 1970s or what happened in the 1930s. There will be something about this model that is wrong, that we just don't understand right now, and we'll be hit with that whenever this era changes. And I think we've got a long way before that changes. I think we've got at least a good decade or two before that kind of, you know, paradigmatic shift moment comes to be.
Yeah, so let's sum everything up with this last question here that's got a couple of straightforward parts. One, you're obviously a writer in residence, so I'm guessing you'll be spending some time writing, focusing on a new work. So it'd be great to get a preview, not of like the book, but like what topics are you interested in delving into in the same way that you're focused on history and then getting something deep. And then two, talking about that paradigm you just discussed, like what do you think that paradigm is and what are the opportunities that everyone, whether they're right, left, or center, is going to be able to look forward to going into the 2020s?
I think so. I'll take the second part first. I think there's going to be a union between the anti-monopoly stuff that has been somewhat popular on the right, but I think has persuaded a lot of people, largely in the sort of establishment center, actually, that there's something amiss with corporate concentration. There's going to be a union between that and this Keynesian social support kind of macroeconomic management. So the microeconomics are going to come from the anti-monopoly stuff, and the macroeconomics are going to come from Keynes. And I think it's going to be a little bit of an uneasy union in places, because I think to some extent, the assumptions of a lot of the anti-monopoly thinkers are really much more aligned with the sort of traditional classical or neoliberal understandings of money and democracy. So it's going to be a little bit uneasy, just to oversimplify the point. There's some anti-monopoly thinkers who say, look, if we just break up these big out of control monopolies, the market will work. Yes. and it will be fine. I don't believe that. I don't think most people who are drawn to anti-monopoly politics believe that, but I think one of the reasons it's popular and has a constituency outside the American left is because there are people who think that way. So I think it will be tricky wedding that with all of the macro management that comes with this sort of broader Keynesian big deficits as a normal sort of part of a functional economy stuff. But I think those two things will be united in a sort of uneasy balance, and something will happen because it's a sort of unholy union. Something will happen to disrupt it. And I can't say what that is, whether it's something that happens in climate change or a war or who knows, but some sort of disaster will happen eventually, nothing lasts forever. But as for what I'm working on next, I have a 2-book deal with Random House. So, the work with Omidyar, I'm advising them on, to some extent, on how to spend their money. And, I have freedom to advise and no freedom to actually award any money. So we'll see how effective that.
Nobody hit up Zach for money. Okay. That's what he said. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I can advocate for you, but I don't have the checkbook, right?
Don't even tell him that. Don't give him an inch. All right. Go ahead.
But the main thing they want me to do is to keep writing for the public and writing for different outlets. This gives me the freedom to not have to be in a newsroom and take a job where I've got to be chained to the news cycle and contributing things that are part of another journalistic institution's just daily grind traffic mm-hmm. needs. So I can write about the ideas that I want to write about, find the right outlet with the right audience for the idea. I've got stuff coming with a whole bunch of different places. I don't think I can, I think it's rude to discuss them, but I've got like 6 pieces in the works right now that are going to come out over the next few weeks. So it probably won't be that load forever, but trying to take a historical approach and a historical lens to this particular moment and show people that, change is normal. Paradigms do shift. And it usually happens, multiple times during people's lifetimes, in fact.
Yeah.
So this sort of thing has happened before. And the other side of it is not necessarily good or bad. It could go a lot of different ways. But the books that I'm working on, the book that I sold to Random House in September is called, tentatively titled Fields of Fire. It's a look at the kind of original breakdown of the gold standard from 1873 to 1896 and the birth of the populist movement across the American South and the American West. Looking at populism as a sort of forgotten fight for multiracial democracy that also broke apart on internal and external racist violence. But that was also a very serious movement of ideas that was trying to make economic policy and advising economic policy in ways that I think really do prefigure what we would eventually call Keynesian economics. They were just, put forward by a bunch of broke farmers, so nobody thought that they were serious ideas. But looking at that connection between financial crisis, economic breakdown, not just immiseration. I think people seem to think there's this clear connection between the worse your life is, the more likely you are to like revolt or become a communist or a fascist. I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think people see a system not working and feel a need to replace it because people aren't stupid. And they are maybe drawn to things that are more radical than they would be drawn to otherwise. And I think that moment is, we don't talk about that as much in our sort of quick sketch of American history, because first of all, the movement fails. But also it just doesn't fit in with other periods of history. You can talk about the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement as being connected in this important, obvious ideological way along both race and economic freedom. But the economic project of the populists and the way that it's sort of connected to a racial liberation ideology, but sort of not, it is connected to a lot of other things in American history, but not to the narratives that we tell ourselves about the country. And I think they're really important to a moment like this, where the narratives that we've told ourselves about the country don't necessarily seem to be making sense. Don't have a lot of power to make sense of this exact moment.
Yeah. You know, Zach, one of the smartest guys I know on this topic. I can't encourage everybody more in order to go and buy Zach's book if you haven't already. We actually sold a bunch of copies, so let's sell some more. It's available on our bookshop. Really appreciate you joining us, man. Send me those pieces whenever they come out. We'll make sure we'll put them out. You always have a spot here on The Realignment. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. We really appreciate it. Go ahead and check out Zach's book on our bookshop, where you can purchase both his book or any book that you guys want. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. And as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We will see you all next week.